Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back for another case of Your Case is on Hold, episode number 46. Just like last time, we're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of publishing JBJS Reviews in November. And it's a collection of the top 10 review articles that you'll be able to see over the 10 years that it's been in public in print. And you get a wonderful editorial by Dr. Tom Einhorn. So this is also brought to you by the Miller Review Course. Sign up, learn, and get your learn on. I'm Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction. And these opinions are of our own, not of the JBJS editorial board or JBJS board or anything like that. And we have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Evidence and Methods.
Welcome aboard. We've got some interesting topics to talk with you guys today. Starting with the top of the pile, there's What's New in Orthopedic Rehabilitation by Castanon. It's permanently free. Glenoid bone loss in recurrent shoulder instability after arthroscopic Bankart repair, a systematic review and meta-analysis. This is by Min, and it's 30 days free. What's important? As surgeons, we need to confront our cognitive biases, which is important to address. By Sahu, this is also permanently free. There's three evidence-based orthopedics article. There's Ramakar on Altshuler, Reddy on Gibbon, and Marmolus on Vecchiezzo. So take a look at those. And then the 2022 American British Canadian or ABC Traveling Fellowship, the post-pandemic tour. One before that was 2019, and then the world ended. This is by Mesfin. And now we can go on to our headlines. Kick us off on Hounsfield Unit Calculated Bone Mineral Density Loss Following Combat-Related Lower Extremity Amputations by Hoyt et al. It's also 30 days free.
Yes, this is a very interesting study that comes to us from Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. The military affiliation was probably evident in the combat-related part of the title. There's been this craze around Hounsfield units for the last couple of years, kind of starting out right before the pandemic, but really catching fire in the last 2 to 3 years, where we've seen a lot, particularly in the spine space. And I myself have done work in this area with other colleagues we have here at the Brigham, which made me interested. And that's really what drove me to select this as my headline. So they're looking at amputations performed within the United States military between 2003 and 2016. It had to be in individuals with multiple CT scans. They were looking at calculating bone mineral density estimated in Hounsfield units, and they used a previously validated method for that. They had 128 patients with 613 femoral neck CT scans available for the analysis. And then they used a lasso multiple logistic regression model to determine the effects of modifiable and non-modifiable variables. That's very important. And then they were looking which factors would be most associated with low bone mineral density and the impact that this would have on individuals with these types of injuries. Among both amputated and non-amputated extremities, due to reduced activity, presumably, there was substantial bone mineral density loss. This occurred over the first 3 years following the injury, and this followed a logarithmic pattern, essentially stabilizing after about 1,000 days. On average, the amputated limbs lost approximately 100 Hounsfield units. And then other factors identified included non-ambulatory status, age at the time of injury, surgical complications that adversely impacted weight bearing, if they had a transtibial amputation, and active vitamin D treatment. So patients with combat-related lower extremity amputations experience a rapid decline. There is an association of vitamin D supplementation with lower Hounsfield units that they do explain reflects this treatment being assigned to patients who already have low bone mineral density. From my standpoint, that probably should have just been taken out. That shouldn't have been an explanatory factor considered in your model, because not only does the explanation not make sense, but then it's also influencing the other factors in a multivariable model that are being accounted for in the estimation. So that can be a problem, meaning it's adjusting some of the other estimates as well. They say that the model assists with clinical decision making. I don't know how much it really assists with clinical decision making. Maybe on the transtibial amputation versus going with something else if you can, but there's going to be a selection and indication restrictions that way, I think, in many respects. So interesting work applying the Hounsfield unit calculation in a different area. I think that by and large, what happens amongst these individuals can be extrapolated to civilian amputations. I don't think that there's any problem in sort of translating this to the civilian sector. But, you know, some of the associations are somewhat common sense. Some of the other ones, I think, are a little bit of an issue with the model that was developed. And that's probably the biggest reservations that I have for this work. But reasonably well done. And they use a mixed effects model. If you want to kind of see the best approaches to doing that, you just need to read the materials and methods their article, and they hit all the high points. So
definitely interesting. You're basing all these data on numbers, right? That's a Hounsfield unit, which doesn't necessarily relate to clinical correlation per se, but at the same time, it is an interesting study looking at that. And there's another study looking at Hounsfield unit later on in this our section as well, too.
This is the Hounsfield issue, of the honorary Hounsfield issue of JBJS.
Not to be confused with Houndstooth, no. But Hounsfield.
That's the right season for Houndstooth too, though. So
I expect a jacket next time, Hounsfield jacket. I'm just saying. I throw it out there. So the next one I'm going to talk about is the diagnostic utility of FAST test for detecting C-reactive protein in synovial fluid and periprosthetic joint infections. By Gerzlecki et al., there's an infographic as well. So the idea here is they're looking for a FAST test to determine infection in synovial fluid. You're trying to find periprosthetic joint infections. There's been all this talk about having a point of care test, right? You take fluid from the joint, you put it on a card, you put it on a leukocyte estrate test, you put it on some sort of, we call it pregnancy test essentially, and you say, boom, this is my answer. This patient's infected or not infected. And that's what people are considering the holy grail of diagnosing infection. They're ideal because the patient's right there. They don't have to drive away. You don't have to think about it back and forth and things like that. But the hard part is a few things. One, as the author made a good point about this in their introduction and said, it's really hard to get fluid from every single joint. And we've all seen it before where we get to that point, they're like, oh, should we lavage the joint? And the lavage is not ideal. Well, the authors here are still reporting on C-reactive protein in synovial fluid in periprosthetic joint infections, meaning they're still looking at synovial fluid. So this is not the end-all be-all answer. I'm going to start there. That said, one of the things that they do point out that's good is that a lot of times you get a tap and it's a bloody tap, or there's definitely other things in there. You don't get this beautiful clear synovial fluid. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't be infected. So if they have a bloody tap, tests like leukocyte esterase do not do well when there's any sort of contaminant in it. Bodily fluids don't do well in those sort of tests. And alpha defensin has a test, but A, it has to still be run by the lab. So you send the fluid down and they do the point of care test in the lab. And then B, it's an expensive test and not all places can do it. What you really want to do is, for diagnosing infection, is have a blood test that's super sensitive, super specific to periprosthetic joint infections that takes a drop of blood and literally like a finger prick test, kind of like a la Theranos style. Now that's my dream in the future. If someone else can do that and run with that from listening to this, congratulations. So the authors here instead look for synovial fluid CRP, which is not a commonly used test in all honesty. Most commonly used test, as every resident will know, is white blood cells and polymorphonucleocytes. So I'm curious as to why they didn't try to find some FAST test that looks specifically at white blood cell counts or polymorphonucleocytes over a certain threshold. But I think what happens here is they are taking some commercially available C-reactive protein FAST test, and they tested a whole host of them, essentially. So they took patients who were septic and aseptic, and they said, okay, we're going to take the fluid from all these individuals and then test them on these to see what their sensitivity and specificity are in the area under the curve. The exclusion criteria was pretty long. So the exclusion criteria included chronic inflammatory disease, because as you can imagine, their ESR and CRP will be elevated, including their synovial fluid CRP. They only looked at chronic PGI, did not look at early PGI. They had a previous history of a native joint infection or PGI. That didn't count. A second stage PGI treatment with spacer. Inconclusive results from the ICM 2018 criteria, which was their definition of infection. treatment with antibiotics in the last 4 weeks before synovial fluid aspiration, periprosthetic fracture, prosthesis dislocation, and malignant disease. They had four fast CRP tests with different cutoff values, and they were cassette, 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 and strip tests. Now, all of them had all different levels of sensitivity and specificity, and they had all different cutoff lab views. But how they grouped them was 1 to 3 milligrams per liter as one cutoff, greater than 8, greater than 10, and the cassette, and then greater than 10 strip. That's kind of how they broke it all down. But each of them had all different cutoff levels. The high sensitivity CRP cassette had only 1 and 3 cutoff, and the ones that went up to 80 milligrams per liter cutoff. So all different areas here. They had 160 patients that met criteria. Interestingly enough, 25% of the patients couldn't be excluded because they either had dry taps or had an aspiration of an insufficient amount. So to the point, it's not always possible to get fluid. So it's not the holy grail of diagnostics yet. That said, they looked at 76 patients who underwent aseptic revision and 44 patients who underwent chronic PJI revision. And the best cutoffs for the fast CRP test were greater than 3 milligrams per liter for the high sensitivity CRP test, greater than 8 milligrams per liter for the CRP screen test, greater than 10 milligrams per liter for the CRP test that's cassette, and also greater than 10 milligrams per liter for the strip test. The over 8 milligrams is kind of like the overall area demonstrated the best accuracy for the diagnosis of chronic and PJI with a sensitivity of 90.9% and specificity of 90.8%. The cutoff levels greater than 3 had low sensitivity and low specificity. And as you can imagine, as you increase the number, they had low sensitivity but high specificity. The best one was the laboratory method. The statistically calculated threshold of 2.7 milligrams per liter had the highest area under the curve with 90.9% sensitivity and 94.7% specificity. So the take-home message, I think, is it's interesting to take ideas from other fields, right? Other fields must be using this fast CRP that we're not commonly using in orthopedics and testing it. And I encourage researchers on this call to do it with blood, you know, do it with patient with periprosthetic infection in their blood, you know, do it in other joints, things like that. But you still, in this case, need to get synovial fluid. So this could be an adjunct. I wouldn't say it's part of the minor criteria that I would add to the periprosthetic, the definition of periprosthetic joint infection yet, but it will be helpful to see how this marker performs in conjunction with other markers that are available out there and see if there's a good combination that would be good, if there are, you know, sensitivity and specificity increase by participating in certain areas. But right now, not something I would use alone, definitely have to use in conjunction with others.
The ancient Egyptians postulated 7 souls, and we postulate that there are 3 criteria that must be met for a diagnostic study. The first being that the test is used in every individual who can qualify for the test, and also that there's sufficient representation across all possible iterations of the disease state being studied. That goes for, you know, the most fulminant obvious case of infection to the case that you are sure is an infection but turns out to be that way. And then the third is that this is compared, that the performance of the test in question is compared to some kind of gold standard. A lot of retrospective studies, and this is a retrospective diagnostic study, well, at least a lot of retrospective studies have trouble doing this. This may just be a diagnostic level 3 study that isn't necessarily retrospective. They have a very small number of patients. 120 is not a lot of patients for this kind of thing, especially if you consider the criteria around you have to have adequate representation across all possible manifestations of the disease state for a high quality diagnostic study. So amongst this limited group, the performance measures are what you see here. I think this is proof of concept. It shows the viability of this idea. I don't think it can say much more beyond that.
Agreed with you there. All right. Your case is on hold is substantial loss of skeletal muscle mass occurs after femoral fragility fractures. This is by Williott et al. Visual summary, and it's permanently free. I thought this was a very interesting research topic, and I really liked how this was an OTA-funded study that was cross-collaborative around 2 institutions, one in Iowa and one in Oregon. And the question that I always ask is, what happens with patients who sustain fragility fractures? And almost all of our studies with regards to follow-up are they ambulating or not? What their patient-reported outcomes are? What's their reoperation? You know, their survival, things like that. We don't actually look at their skeletal muscle mass because it's hard to measure. So these investigators did a good job looking at skeletal muscle mass after femoral fragility fractures. And they also looked at nutritional status and how it impacted the loss of skeletal muscle mass. We know that with sarcopenia, there's age-related decline in muscle mass and strength. So this is something that's important to look at because if they lose muscle mass, patients have increased risk of mortality and impaired healing and impaired function, essentially. So this study looked at changes in skeletal muscle mass and looked at the relationship between malnutrition and physical function and identified risk factors for skeletal muscle loss in patients greater than 85 years old who were treated with operative fixation of an isolated femoral fragility fracture. So this is not a patient who was in a major car accident or multiple injuries. This is an isolated femoral fracture, and it had to come from something like a ground level fall. It had to be a low energy trauma or something equivalent to that. The exclusion criteria were patients who were unable to provide informed consent, non-ambulatory status. They couldn't do some sort of body composition measurement, such as they had a pacemaker, an inability to perform oral food intake at the time of enrollment, and injuries that occurred greater than 72 hours. Now, I kind of would have actually still liked to see patients who were greater than 72 hours because I'm assuming that their muscle mass probably could even be worse. And I want to see if delay of surgery affected muscle mass, but they excluded these patients for the sake of this study. Again, this is two centers, and a skeletal muscle mass was assessed within 72 hours of admission using a multi-frequency bioelectric impedance analysis. And this was again repeated at 6 weeks, 3 months, and 6 months, a pretty intensive study. They looked at total body weight, body mass index, and appendicular skeletal mass index. This is the ratio of appendicular skeletal muscle mass to height. They used sarcopenia as defined by specific sex-specific cutoffs for appendicular skeletal muscle mass index. From a nutritional perspective, they looked at the mini nutritional assessment, and they also looked at if they had inadequate protein intake using the protein screener 55+, or the Pro 55+. Sounds like a cool workout device, but it's a screening tool. So physical function was measured using the PROMIS physical function domain at the time of injury, 3 months and 6 months after injury, and looked at a bunch of covariates that could affect outcomes. And these included age, sex, tobacco use, five-factor modified frailty index, pre-injury use of assistive device for ambulation, pre-injury assistance required for activities of daily living, discharge disposition, and the fracture type based on all the different classifications and location of fracture. So you use linear mixed models, which is typically used in this sort of setting. And they had 90 participants, 74% were women with mean age of 77.6. At one follow-up, at least 71 completed at least one follow-up. Six patients unfortunately passed away within 6 months of injury. At the time of injury, 33% were sarcopenic and 49% were at risk of malnutrition or had malnutrition. Predictably, older age greater than 75 was associated with lower skeletal muscle mass. Patients who had greater muscle mass were male or had subtrochanteric or diaphyseal fractures, which is probably what would be expected. From the time of injury to 6 weeks, participants lost an average of 2.4 kilograms of skeletal muscle mass, and this early loss did not recover by 6 months. Now, I would love to see the study go out to 1 year and 2 years to see if it makes a difference, but we know that hip fracture patients, unfortunately, the mortality is pretty high within the first year, so I'm not 100% sure that longer follow-up would necessarily help here, but it's interesting to think of. The loss in skeletal muscle mass did not recover from 6 weeks to 3 months. There was a slight recovery between 3 to 6 months, but really it was a 0.7 kilogram gain. If you had normal nutritional status, you actually had greater skeletal muscle mass loss. And that's probably because you had more to begin with, so you had more to lose. And they had higher PROMIS physical function scores with those who have normal nutritional levels. However, participants with normal nutritional status lost more muscles compared to those who were malnourished from baseline to 6 weeks and on. And they had a greater decrease in their PROMIS physical function score between baseline and 3 months compared to those who were malnourished. So the thought process is those who were malnourished probably didn't have as high physical function and potentially they didn't have as much of a drop because they didn't have as much of a drop in their muscle mass. I think the Kaiser Sose of this potentially could be a 1 kilogram decrease in skeletal muscle mass was associated with an 8-point decrease in the promised physical function score. So that would probably be my take-home message to think and noodle about. And you can tell patients, look, you've sustained this fracture. You're likely to lose some muscle mass, and loss of this muscle mass is going to affect your physical function. Patients come in, they came in and had a, you know, ground level fall, and they're like, well, I was, you know, walking 3 miles a day before this, you know, will I get back to that? And I go, well, maybe not. And that's hard reality to take in. Interestingly enough, the change in skeletal muscle mass did not vary by age group, fracture type, functional status, modified frailty index, sex, or smoking status. But patients who did not require an assistive walking device for ambulation prior to injury experienced greater loss of muscle mass from time of injury to 6 weeks. And it's probably similar to the nutrition group, right? They had probably better muscle mass to begin with. They didn't need an assistive device versus those who required a device. Looking at sarcopenia, there were 9 participants out of the 71 who had at least one follow-up. The 9 participants without sarcopenia at baseline, they lost enough appendicular skeletal muscle mass during the 6-month follow-up to become sarcopenic. So they started off as non-sarcopenic, became sarcopenic. Patients who progressed to sarcopenia were significantly older and were more likely to have a hip fracture. So the type of fracture, all these sorts of things, like it'd be nice to see a little bit more detail about the patient population, if possible, right? They covered a lot of the different areas. I'm glad they added modified frailty index and functional status, but potentially the type of fracture fixation, postoperative weight-bearing status, postoperative mobility, access to rehabilitation resources, postoperative nutrition, laboratory values such as albumin and protein would really enhance the study and give me a little bit more background. It's in, well, what's normal nutrition? Use one test for normal nutrition, but what were nutrition levels at? And what were the labs then? What were the labs like postoperatively as well too? But it's good to note these changes, and every study ends with future studies need to blank, blank, blank. In this case, actually, future studies really would be instrumental to prevent muscle mass in older adults, especially those who sustain femoral fragility fractures, regardless of the nutritional status. And I think that's a good charge to leave people with.
Yeah, a lot of corollaries here, even between the Hounsfield study, just sort of getting at similar phenomena in two different populations. I think you had a good point on the Kaiser-Soze phenomena that may be present with that 1 kilogram decrease, that definitely seems like test material. I would say my biggest concern for this work is it's just 90 participants, which means that, you know, all those things that they're telling you are not significant. They may just be underpowered to detect those differences. And with just 90 participants, again, how adequately represented the universe of possible permutations of these individuals across the intersection of body mass and fracture type and events following the surgery and recovery, you know, like in each of like those 10 cells, maybe you have 9 patients or something like that, or some with none. And so that, you know, what always seems to start out as a waterfall ends up being a trickle when you get down into like the nitty gritty. And I think there are some interesting findings. I think some of this you probably anticipate. I do think their take-home message is appropriately nuanced. And overall, check it out.
Look good. Moving to the honorable mentions. The first one is opioid-free analgesia provides pain control following thumb carpometacarpal joint arthroplasty by Haisong et al. There's an infographic on this. This is a randomized controlled trial on opioid-free versus opioid-containing pain control when undergoing thumb carpometacarpal joint arthroplasty. The authors found that at 24 hours postoperatively, pain scores in the opioid-free group were statistically not inferior to and actually lower than those in the opioid-containing group. And pain scores were still different at 2 weeks, but they were actually similar at 6 weeks. So a take-home message is you don't need to use opioids for thumb metacarpal joint arthroplasty. And pretty compelling reviews and results, and you actually would have less pain probably in the first 2 weeks. Tibial tubercle osteotomy in revision total knee arthroplasty for periprosthetic infection, indications and outcomes. This is by Kantz et al. The purpose of the study were to determine the rates of complications and revisions due to tibial tubercle osteotomy during revision total knee arthroplasty in the setting of a prosthetic infection, the rate of septic failure and the functional outcomes at a minimum of 2-year follow-up in 68 patients. Most people are afraid to do a TTO when doing a revision total knee arthroplasty for infection because they're afraid that the TTO will either not unite or become infected. It found out that 7 knees or 10% had complications secondary to the TTO, 3 had fracture displacement of the TPO, 2 non-union, one delayed union, and one wound dehiscence. The time to union was approximately 3.8 months. In 18 knees, which was 26.5%, had recurrence of infection requiring revision, which is a pretty high number. Overall, 42.6% of infected knees managed with this revision total knee arthroplasty with the TTO procedure were considered successful without any complication at the last follow-up, but only 2 or 3% required revision related to the TTO. Evaluation of pulmonary function after halo pelvic traction for severe and rigid kyphoscoliosis utilizing CT with 3D reconstruction. This was 28 patients with severe and rigid scoliosis with a Cobb angle greater than 100 who underwent preoperative halo pelvic traction. Interestingly enough, and though the numbers are small, this is not very commonly used, but none of the patients had pulmonary complications during traction and all radiographic spinal measurements improved significantly after the halo pelvic traction. As a bonus, lung function also got better. There was an increase in total lung volume, maximum lung height, and total lung capacity. And finally, bring it back into the Hallenfield unit, ankle joint bone density distribution correlates with overall three-dimensional foot and ankle alignment by Lintz et al. The purpose of the study was to evaluate the spatial distribution of bone mineral density with the use of weight-bearing cone beam computed tomography. They looked at 27 normally aligned hind feet, and they were compared to 27 valgus and 27 varus aligned hind feet. Probably not super surprising, but if the hind foot alignment and medial to lateral, not surprising that the hind foot alignment, varus and valgus, and the medial lateral bone mineral density distributions were correlated. In a varus hind foot, there was increased Hallenfield unit consistent with greater medial bone density. And in the valgus hind foot, there was greater bone density in the lateral compartment. So there's how you can use your Hallenfield unit in the ankle as well. We thank everyone for their time. Hope you enjoyed what you heard. Tune on in next week or next time for the next episode.
Definitely not next week.
Yeah, it's not next week. You don't listen to us that often. So in 2 weeks from now, and your case on hold, we look forward to hearing from you guys.